Football Weekly is on the air.
Here's the snap.
Drops back.
Throws the ball. The long ball downfield. Pass is tipped and it is intercepted.
Gets away. Breaks the tackle. He's still going.
50, 45, 40, 30.
He's going to go all the way.
Runs left to the 20, to the 10, to the 5.
And he strikes into the end zone.
Touchdown.
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 This is Wayne Larrabee with Hubbard-Kirsch. Welcome to Pro Football Weekly, an in-depth look at professional football this week. Coming up in the headliner, Manning Brady 14.
Were the officials correct in the Niners-Saints ruling, or how about the Panthers-Patriots game, and what is next for the Dallas Cowboys?
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Along with Hub Arkish, this is Wayne Larrabee on Pro Football Weekly. The way we hear it features news and information from around the NFL, and this segment we pick it up with Arthur Arkish of USA Today. Guys, I don't know if I've ever seen a way we hear it segment totally on officiating, but that's what we're about to delve into here. Let's start first off the fallout from Ahmad Brooks' hit, fine, talk around the league about the situation and how it might have cost San Francisco that football game last week at New Orleans. But let's start out with you. Your impression, number one, of the situation, the hit by Brooks, was it a legal play? And number two, what about the fine aspect of it?
Well, Wayne, and this is all going to be a matter of opinion. It's a very subjective conversation. I don't think there's any question it was a legal play, and I'm going to explain for a moment with the description that the league has given of it makes it a legal play. While they're fining him, what they've said is that Ahmad Brooks did hit Drew Brees initially across the chest, up just below the shoulders, and then as the play continued, his arm rose up and caught him across the neck. Well, by definition, if he hit him, below the neck, it's not his fault what happens once they start falling or moving or whatever's going to happen. But beyond that, it clearly is football. It's the play that all these guys are taught to make, and in this case, it results in a strip, a fumble, a recovery by the 49ers. I'm not going to say for sure that the 49ers win the game, but when the officials start dictating the outcome of games, then you've got a real problem, and that's why we're talking about it in this segment, and more than that, that's why there is outrage around the league. Now, there are people who support the call, but I am hearing from the overwhelming majority of players and coaches, and even a couple officials I've been able to talk to, they just don't see how that is an illegal play by the strict definition of the rules. And when the league acknowledges it in their own explanation, then they go fine Ahmad Brooks to make their point. And they say, yeah, he hit him right initially, but then he rose up and hit him in the neck as the play continued on. At some point, they're going to destroy the game with this stuff.
I couldn't stand the fact either that this did have a big impact on the outcome of the game. And I think it's very important to separate issues here. I mean, it's clear that the NFL's number one priority is protecting the quarterback. This is a separate thing than some of the head-to-head hits and some of the concussion issues that are arising around the league. But as I said, if the NFL is concerned first and foremost about protecting the quarterback, coddling the quarterback, I don't agree with it, but I thought it was pretty obvious that he got clotheslined. There was a major collision, near his neck and the way he was jostled down to the field. I would have been very surprised if the flag wasn't thrown. Again, I wish it didn't happen because it had such a big impact on the outcome of the game. But to me, the way that we've seen things getting officiated this season, that was a very obvious call. It's unfortunate in the Thursday night game, there was a couple that were missed on Matt Ryan that seemed just as egregious. But I guess that does kind of show, identify that there is still a bit of a gray area on this issue.
I don't think there's any question about it. And the officials in a tough spot, too, in recent years being placed, the game's happening at warp speed. They're being placed in a position where they have to make judgments on some of these things on the fly. But, there's still more fallout on the officials this week from the Patriots-Panthers game, the last play of that game. Luke Kuechly holding Rob Gronkowski in the end zone at the end of that loss in Carolina on Monday night. Now, you've got to take a look at this, Hub. And again, these calls have bearing not just on one game, but on an entire playoff race in two conferences.
It does, and this one not quite as egregious, I think, only because, here's the last play of the game. The Patriots put themselves in that situation, and We've all seen the uncatchable ball call, which is what they turned this into. Yes, the back judge threw the flag with authority. He saw the holding. We've all seen it. There's no question Luke Kuechly was holding Rob Gronkowski, but it was out of the play, and here's where it gets complicated. There are some who interpret the rule to say, once the ball is in the air, holding goes away. It's not holding, it's pass interference, and for pass interference, the ball must be catchable. Well, in this case, it probably wasn't catchable. That's always been a judgment call. It's very different from this roughing, protecting the player stuff. And to me, it's clearly holding, so I think what the league needs to do is look at the rule there, not so much as what those officials did, because we have seen conferences and we have seen flags picked up in many other situations, Arthur, where they say the ball wasn't catchable.
Yeah, we have. And you know, I thought that the back judge had the call right initially. I thought that picking up the flag was clearly a mistake and that the Patriots got kind of job there. But I love what you said initially in that New England didn't lose the game solely on that call. They had a third and goal on the offensive series before Carolina drove down the field for the game-winning score. They weren't able to punch it in. And there's a number of different areas you can look at from that game why they lost. But again, you throw the flag, it seems so obvious, and for the back judge to not be the one who ends up ruling on it after he's the one who decided it was a penalty initially, to me, is just wrong, and I think a big part of the reason why there's so much outrage in New England.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, Arthur, regardless of whether the officials did the right thing or not, it just looks bad if the average fan is watching that play. Why would they pick up that flag? We'll be back with more Way We Hear It when your current edition of Pro Football Weekly continues. You're listening to Pro Football Weekly, featuring Hub Arkush with news and notes the way we hear it from across the NFL. And we're joined for this segment by Eric Edholm of Shutdown Corner on Yahoo Sports. And guys, let's begin with the RG3 story in Washington. The quarterback of the Redskins kind of called out Hub for a lack of leadership by Redskins, both on the team in the person of Santana Moss and no longer on the team in the person of Daryl Green and Sonny Jurgensen. Explain.
Well, yeah, this story has all kinds of tentacles to it, and it really, it's gotten legs because it's coming from so many different directions. During the broadcast of the Eagles Redskins game last week, it was Sonny Jurgensen, the Hall of Famer, calling for the benching of RG3 just because of the way he was playing. And then actually just prior to the game, I believe it was, the former, you know, Hall of Fame cornerback Daryl Green said that he lacked leadership. Now, Green has since tried to back off those comments a little bit, but not really. He's still saying that they could use more leadership. And then I think the crunching blow, Eric, came when Santana Moss, in his radio show on Tuesday — this is a guy who's still in the huddle — said, hey, every once in a while, you just got to step up and take responsibility. You know, you can't keep saying, we didn't do this or they didn't get that done. Our leader has to lead, basically. I'm paraphrasing. And so when you see it coming from this many directions, it's hard to say that it's not an issue. I don't want to call it a problem, but it's at least an issue with the Washington Redskins that RG3 is not taking command of this football team.
Well, I will say there are a lot of voices in Washington. It seems like anybody who played at least three seasons for the Redskins has their own radio show these days. But, you know, obviously there is a lot of discussion. Everybody's assuming that, you know, he's taken this major step back. I mean, first of all, there are a lot of factors involved here. I think them winning last year was probably one of the worst things that could have happened, because there were a lot of people out there who felt he needed a couple of years to progress, not only as a player, but as a leader. Yes, he was considered mature coming out of college, but very few guys, I think, are prepared for the cauldron that is Washington, D.C. and Redskins football. I really believe that it's just one of those epicenters where if you're not mentally ready for the daily grind that comes with it, the focus and the hot fire that comes with the media attention, it's nothing like anything you could experience in Waco, Texas. I can say that for sure. So, yeah, there is a lot of criticism here. It has come from the players. It has come from other sources, former players, media, et cetera. This is to be expected, though, and I think Griffin obviously needs to work on some things a little bit, watch Peyton Manning, watch Tom Brady, watch Andrew Luck a little bit, and learn how to deal with some of these situations.
Well, you know, guys, last year at this time, the Redskins were sitting there, what, about 3-6 mm-hmm. or thereabouts before mm-hmm. they went on a 7-game winning streak. Now, they're 3-7 right now, so, you know, they caught fire on that winning streak and everything was smoothed over, but they weren't probably as good a team as 10-6 would suggest last year, Eric. Is that what you were saying?
I think so. I mean, they were plus 17 in turnovers a year ago. It covered up a lot of their defensive weaknesses. You know, it masked the fact that they, you know, outside of Pierre Garçon, they really didn't have a go-to receiver. There were some offensive line issues that were covered up by the scheme and such. So I think, you know, Griffin made some heroic plays last year. He was outstanding at times. You know, there's obviously some covering up there, I think, that was going on. That then when I'm coming into this year, I look at the secondary, I looked at some of their offensive issues. I said, this looks like a 7-win team at best.
Yeah, it's funny, Wayne, when Eric said it seems like anybody who played more than 3 years with the Redskins has their own radio show. I thought he was going to say anybody who played more than 3 years with the Redskins is part of the broadcast team. And I love all the guys in that booth, but it's a tough one to listen to. And Sonny, God bless him, you know, is a great NFL player, but I'm not sure Sonny is completely in touch with today's NFL player to be making a comment like that.
All right, let's stick with the Redskins. Offensive tackle Trent Williams, after last week's game, charged NFL official Roy Ellison with cussing him out on the field last week in that game at Philadelphia. But Bob, the more layers we peel off of this story, the more we find that whatever Ellison said to Williams, how inappropriate it might have been, apparently didn't come out of the blue.
Well, no, and this story is now coming courtesy of John Wooten of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, which is a group formed to promote diversity in hiring in the NFL. And so it's a group that tries to help minorities. And there are allegations that, in fact, what happened is that Ellison said something to Williams, and Williams turned around and used the N-word against him. Now, both these gentlemen are black. And we know, you go back to the Dolphins, the Richie Incognito thing, this has become a real hot button around the NFL. Williams denies using the word, but says, even if I did, he should have thrown a flag right there, and he didn't. We have not heard from Ellison, and so it's an unfortunate story. But, Eric, again, these stories get legs, and when you get into this sensitive area, you're going to have some problems.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they're asking people to stop using the N-word. I think that's a great place to start, and you know, when you have these accusations, it just looks really ugly from the outside, and you wonder, you know, how much of this is really going on. And obviously, with the more media attention, the more cameras, the more guys are mic'd up around the NFL, you're gonna probably hear more of these stories. And so it's unfortunate. I think it's a good start to get the name calling to a minimum.
Hub, really quick, Miles Austin, DeMarcus Ware for the Cowboys, set to go against the Giants at a big game this weekend, but neither 100%. And Jerry Jones weighed in on his coach this week as well, didn't he?
Yeah, I think DeMarcus Ware has shown he's a warrior. He's not 100%, maybe shouldn't be on the field. Miles Austin coming back with those bad hamstrings. Don't know that they're rushing him so much, as he may not be ready either. But, Eric, the most interesting piece, we'll ask you real quickly. Jerry Jones has said emphatically Jason Garrett will be his coach again in 2014, and you wonder where he's getting that great confidence from.
Right, 500 football the last 17 years or whatever it is, and just continued through the Garrett era. And, you know, it's not all on him. I mean, obviously his defensive coordinator, Monty Kiffin, was forced on him. You wonder if there's perhaps not some more changes coming to the rest of the coaching staff if Garrett returns.
All right, thank you very much, Eric. We'll talk with you a little bit later on in the program. The games are up next on Pro Football Weekly. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. This is Wayne Larrabee along with Hub Arkish. In the NFL this weekend, the Buffalo Bills, Cincinnati Bengals, Philadelphia Eagles, and Seattle Seahawks have the week off. New Orleans, meanwhile, began the weekend by holding off Atlanta 17-13 in a, I think, Hub, a predictably sloppy Thursday night game in Atlanta. With the win, the Saints remain atop the NFC South, just a game back of the Seahawks in the race for the top seed of the NFC playoffs with a 9-2 record. The Falcons, a preseason favorite, injury-decimated fall to 2-9. And, Hub, the reason I said it's somewhat predictable, number one, I think it's real hard for football teams to play on just 3 days' rest and preparation. But the other thing is that's, you know, New Orleans, for those who aren't familiar with the NFC South, New Orleans, Atlanta is a big game. It's a rivalry game.
When the next good Thursday night game we see will be the first one, I couldn't agree more. It's just not the way to play football. I understand the financial ramifications of it. That's number one. Number two, New Orleans, I'm trying to decide, are they the best in the NFC or not? They've certainly got the best balance between great offense and very good defense, but they got some help against the 49ers. Now they bounce back and struggle with a mediocre team like the Falcons. They still need to get some momentum as they head towards the playoffs.
All right, let's go on to MetLife Stadium, an important NFC East Division matchup. Talk about rivalries here, Hub. The Dallas Cowboys and the resurgent New York Giants. Cowboys began the season with a 36-31 victory over the Giants in Dallas in week one. Giants got off to that 0-6 start. Now, and again, you and I might debate on this, but their four-game winning streak, while not always pretty, has nonetheless given them something to play for in December.
Oh, we won't debate that at all. No, I mean, they're right in the thick of the NFC least race now, you know, and so are the Cowboys right there. The Cowboys coming off a bye and a terrible beatdown from the New Orleans Saints. Giants, their four opponents they've beaten aren't all that impressive, but four wins in a row, and the Giants are taking the ball away on defense. They've started to run the ball just a little bit now with Andre Brown back, Eli Manning not giving it away as much. Talked in the way we hear it about the Cowboys. If DeMarcus Ware and Miles Austin were 100% healthy, I might feel better about their chances here, but we don't know what they're going to get out of Austin. And you got Ware playing on one leg until they get Sean Lee back. That defense is vulnerable. Winner here, very much alive in the NFC East. The loser, you know, pretty much at least out of the wild card, if not alive in the East as well.
And Hub, I had a chance to see the Giants firsthand last week. You're exactly right. The Giants are starting to look like the Giants. Andre Brown, Brandon Jacobs returned last week. If they can run the football and do a little pound and ground type of stuff, Eli limits his mistakes as he has been doing in recent weeks. That defense has been rock solid. And again, as we mentioned, the opponents they've played have, for whatever reason, one reason or another, injuries or whatever else, as was the case with the Packers, the opponents they've beaten in this four-game streak have not been the highest of quality, but nonetheless, four-game winning streak, and the Giants are right back in the race of the East. Let's move on to the AFC. The 4-6 Steelers on the road to take on the 4-6 Browns in an AFC North Division contest. Pittsburgh is 4-2, Hub, after that 0-4 start. Are the Steelers trying to make a turn here, starting to anyway?
Well, they're trying, and yes, at 4-6, much like the NFC East, although I think the AFC North is a much better division, they are still alive. They're only a game back in the wild card chase, but they're flawed, Wayne. What we saw, the Patriots absolutely destroyed them through the air a couple of weeks ago, and then they come back against the Lions, and while they did get a win, the Lions took them apart for the first two quarters of that game. So I think the Steelers can play with competition like this, but I'm not sure that they're back to the heyday and ready to be a playoff team again.
NFC North Division leading Detroit Lions look to get back on track as they take on the improving 2-8 Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Since starting 3-1, the Lions are just 3-3, coming off a loss to the Steelers in Pittsburgh. After starting the season with 8 straight losses, the Bucs have won 2 in a row with wins over Miami and Atlanta. How do you see this one?
It's ironic the Bucs are playing better, because what I'm hearing out of that locker room is they really don't like their coach, and that's still a very fragile situation, but they're playing for him, and that's all that matters. As far as the Lions, I'm guessing some crazy fan might have TP'd Jim Schwartz's house this week. They were not happy about the decision to go on the fake field goal in that Steeler game. I don't know that it turns the game around, but it was shaky. I happen to be a Jim Schwartz fan. This team is capable of great things on offense. This defense is not quite there yet, but this is a game at home, getting ready for Thanksgiving. They know how to do it. I think the Bucs may be in trouble in this one.
The Green Bay Packers have lost 3 in a row since quarterback Aaron Rodgers went down with a collarbone injury. They haven't won since beating the Vikings 44-31 last month. They rematch with Minnesota this week in Lambeau Field. The Vikings start Christian Ponder at quarterback, but their season has imploded primarily due to the lack of production at that key position. And they take a 2-1 record into this game at Lambeau Field against the Packers. Green Bay 5-5. Faces as close to a must-win situation, Hub, as you can, with still 6 games to go in the season. The injuries have obviously disfigured Green Bay.
Yeah, it's a must-win because they're chasing both the Lions and the Bears by a game, and they're going to have to get the Lions 4 days later. I look at the Vikings, and, you know, this team isn't that different from the team that was a playoff team last year. They're just not playing well. You don't know what you're going to get at quarterback or who to expect or who to prepare for. To me, this is about the Packers. You know, Wayne, I didn't think Tolzien looked that bad except for a couple of bad decisions that kids are going to make. The interceptions are what killed him against the Giants. If he continues to settle down, they should have a shot at home if that defense plays a little bit better.
Two teams that have combined for all of 3 wins between them meet in Houston as the 2-8 Texans host the 1-9 Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yeah, I think we've said enough about this. The Jags are starting to play a little better under Gus Bradley. Wait, I don't see any way Gary Kubiak can keep his job. I think the question is, does GM Rick Smith stick around as well? Because this was a Houston team that was supposed to contend for a Super Bowl that is contending for the top pick in the draft.
Oakland Raiders play host to the Tennessee Titans. Both teams bring 4-6 records into the contest, but the Raiders come in off a 28-23 win at Houston, while the Titans have lost 2 in a row after a 4-4 start.
And I think the difference is the Titans are a disappointing 4-6 team. I think the Raiders at 4-6, I don't love the talent on this team. There's nobody at quarterback. They got free agent Matt McGloin, an undrafted free agent rookie playing now. I'm very impressed with the job Dennis Allen has done with this football team.
4-6 San Diego Chargers in Kansas City, where the 9-1 Chiefs are coming off their first loss of the season. Hub, after a 4-3 start, the Chargers have now lost three in a row.
Yeah, and I did that Chiefs-Broncos game for Westwood One last week. I was terribly disappointed in the Chiefs' defense. They didn't breathe hard on Peyton Manning. I think that that Phillip Rivers and the San Diego Chargers have had trouble blocking for the pass are going to pay for that this week as the Chiefs get ready for their bounce-back game against the Broncos next week.
Monday night, San Francisco 49ers take their 6-4 record into FedEx Field to face the 3-7 Washington Redskins.
Another game like the Chiefs and the Chargers where I wouldn't want to be the Redskins. I don't think the Niners are very happy about what happened in New Orleans last week. I know Ahmad Brooks is not. The Redskins not playing very good football. Normally, I don't like these West Coast teams on these coast-to-coast trips, but in this one, I think Harbaugh has his boys ready.
San Francisco has lost to Seattle, Indy, Carolina, and New Orleans. Those teams are a combined 33-9. Coming up, we start breaking down the big games this weekend on Pro Football Weekly. We resume with this regular season edition of Pro Football Weekly. Wayne Larrabee with Hub Arkish. We're again joined by Arthur Arkish of USA Today. Couple of big games. The New York Jets at Baltimore in the AFC. The 5-5 Jets to face the 4-6 Ravens. And guys, you know, hard to get a handle on this ball game. I agree with what you said off the air, Arthur. Kind of hard to get a handle on this because Baltimore is a team that looks like they're about to turn their season around, and then something happens like the Chicago game a week ago where they encounter a terrible storm and then lose the ball game down the stretch.
Yeah, and it says a lot about the NFL, that a game that still has major playoff implications. There's some interesting angles. You've obviously got Rex Ryan and the new Ed Reed returning to Baltimore, so there's going to be a lot of intrigue there, but the bottom line is that the Jets are making history for their inconsistency this season, have not won back-to-back games or lost back-to-back games through the first 11 weeks, which is quite remarkable. You talked about the Ravens a little bit and the way they fell apart last week in the stormy weather in Chicago, and you know, John Harbaugh, who's one of the best coaches in the NFL, isn't having one of his finest seasons. He clearly got outcoached by a rookie in Mark Trussman in Chicago, and you know, they still can't run the ball. They were able to get it going against Chicago, but I don't expect them to have that same kind of luck against the number one NFL run defense in New York.
You know, guys, it's actually a bit of a byplay here, but who'd have thought Ed Reed would have two returns to Baltimore this year? Remember, he went back earlier in the season with Houston. Everybody thought that was it. Now he comes back again. He's really not the story here, though. You know, Arthur, you say John Harbaugh got outcoached in Chicago. Certainly, Trestman had a good game. But when your quarterback is Joe Flacco, you're going to get outcoached pretty regularly. I mean, Flacco has just been bad. You can't even say he's underperformed. He's been bad. And last week, what kept the Ravens competitive was Ray Rice finally exploded, had over 130 yards on the ground, more than half of what he had in his first nine games, and yet now you get the New York Jets' number one run defense, so you've got to count on Flacco if you're going to win, and he has not been able to get the job done for them. I look at the Jets, guys, what a problem for John Idzik and Woody Johnson. What do you do with Rex Ryan? You know, I mean, one week it looks like you got to give him a contract extension. The next week, not that it's his fault, it's really Geno Smith that is causing this Jekyll and Hyde thing. As Arthur, we were talking, you know, he's not ready to play quarterback in this league. He may be a fine QB someday, but you know, Rex Ryan has established he's a really good defensive coach. That's bad news for the Baltimore Ravens, who struggle so much on offense, but the Jets offense has been horrible periodically as well, and that's what kind of makes this one a coin toss.
Yeah, and the Jets come in at 5-5 into that ballgame. Ravens are 4-6. Meanwhile, the Chicago Bears, coming off a dramatic win in overtime against the aforementioned Ravens, meet the St. Louis Rams in the Edward Jones Dome in St. Louis. The Bears tied with Detroit record-wise atop the NFC North, although they lose the tiebreakers to the Lions. But this is a matchup of backup quarterbacks. And I'll tell you what, Hub, of the backup quarterbacks out there plying their trade right now, and there seem to be a bevy of them in the league this year, Josh McCowns is about as good as it gets in that regard.
Well, he's got a 100 passer rating in his 2.5 starts now. They are 2-0 in those games that he has started. They should have won or almost won the game in which he tried to lead the comeback against the Redskins. He will start against the St. Louis Rams. The Rams, as you mentioned, will have Kellen Clemens going. Clemens hasn't been horrible, but not nearly as good as McCown. And one of the differences is there aren't a lot of backup quarterbacks that have the weapons to work with that Josh McCown does. You've got arguably as good a pair of wideouts in the league as you're going to find. in Brandon Marshall and Alshon Jeffrey, at least if you look at their production. And Matt Forte is a Pro Bowl running back. The offensive line is improved. It's not great. But what McCown is doing is administering this, quote, quarterback-friendly offense and not making a lot of mistakes. But, you know, Arthur, the flip side of it for me is some of it's being done with mirrors, too, because Josh McCown, on his career, five teams, had been out of the game over a year, was coaching high school football when the Bears had found him, had thrown considerably more interceptions than he had touchdowns in his nine-year career, and now he's got, what, four or five touchdowns and no picks. He's taking care of the football, but you keep waiting for Josh McCown to become Josh McCown, and when you look at this St. Louis Rams pass rush, that may be something or is something that I think should concern the Bears coaches.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as well as the Bears offensive line played last week against Baltimore's pass rush, which is not one to, you know, to turn a nose up at. This is a step up in class. You got Robert Quinn, you got Chris Long. That's the most feared edge tandem in the league for my money. And it's going to be a huge, huge test for Jermon Bushrod and Jordan Mills. A lot of other interesting angles in this game as well. We know the Bears cannot stop the run to save their lives. They've got a pretty good running football team, at least one that's been greatly improved over recent weeks with Zach Stacy leading the charge, the fifth round rookie. So that's definitely going to be another interesting angle to keep an eye on and see if the Bears are able to slow down the Rams' run game. You know, another interesting matchup I'm very excited to see is Julius Peppers against Jake Long. That was, of course, the Rams' biggest offseason acquisition, and Julius Peppers is coming off not only his best game of the season, but just a really heroic effort in that big win in Baltimore. He was the best player on the field. So lots of interesting matchups to keep an eye on. The Bears go on the road after being at home the past couple weeks, and the Rams are coming off a bye and their biggest win of the season before the bye. So something's got to give. I think this could be an interesting matchup.
And one other quick note here, Wayne. That game last week, as heroic as the Bears were, it was played in quicksand in those awful conditions. The St. Louis Rams may be the fastest team in the NFL. They've got incredible team speed. This one is indoors on their racetrack, and that could be a factor.
We'll have more breakdowns of NFL games this weekend when we return to Pro Football Weekly. We continue with this Week 12 edition of Pro Football Weekly and welcome Eric Edholm back to the program. He's the staff writer for Shutdown Corner, yahoosports.com. Well, Hub and Eric, let's talk a little bit about this Week 12 matchup between the Indianapolis Colts at 7-3 and the Arizona Cardinals at 6-4. Now, you know, Hub, if you're the Colts, you've got wins. Just think of some of the marquee wins. At San Francisco, over Seattle, they beat Denver, but, you know, they lose to St. Louis, and they're coming off a tight win at Tennessee, in which they had to come from behind. I don't quite know what to make of the Colts, and I really don't know what to make of the Arizona Cardinals, who come in at 6-4 and are right in the thick of the wild card race with teams like San Francisco and Chicago, Detroit, and whoever else falls out of the NFC East, meaning probably the Eagles at this point.
Well, I can tell you what to make of the Cardinals. They play really good defense. You know, Bruce Arians is the reigning NFL coach of the year. People should not forget that, even though he's a rookie coach in Arizona. We know he's somewhat of an offensive wizard, but he is doing a great job with that Cardinal defense as well. Re-signing Carlos Dansby has turned out to be just a brilliant move. When everybody thought he was done, he is leading that defense once again, having a Pro Bowl-type season. You know, you look at the Indianapolis Colts guys, and yes, they've got those marquee wins, but it was late in that win over the Denver Broncos that Reggie Wayne went down. And since that's happened, they did get destroyed at home by the St. Louis Rams, and they barely came back to beat a mediocre Tennessee team, albeit on Thursday night in Tennessee. They've got to find some answers on offense, Eric. I just don't know that Andrew Luck has the weapons he needs to lead a playoff-type offense. They're a good football team, better than anybody expected them to be. It wasn't just the Chuck Pagano story last year. They've obviously got some talent, but they're lacking in weapons, and that's a curious matchup as they go against this great defense in the desert.
Yeah, you're right, and I think, you know, he's, you know, Luck is having a ping back and forth between Kobe Fleener at tight end, T.Y. Hilton at receiver, and other than those two guys, I don't see a receiver who can separate and catch the ball. I mean, dare say we're banking run, but too many drops there for my liking, and, you know, the other guys just can't be counted on at this point. Trent Richardson, nothing in the run game. Now, I love what Donald Brown did last week, but I don't know if he can keep it up. But I also want to talk about the other side of the ball, and that Colts defense has sort of taken a little step back right when the Cardinals offense is at least making some progress. So, you know, they got Larry Fitzgerald involved last week. Michael Floyd had the long touchdown. They've masked this pretty bad personnel-wise offensive line and done a pretty good job with it. And all of a sudden now Andre Ellington and even Mendenhall's contributing a little bit. So it wouldn't stun me if Bruce Arians knows his personnel well, if they were able to attack this Colts defense and get more yards than we've used to seeing out of the Cardinals.
And again, they get the Colts out in the desert at Arizona. Meanwhile, Carolina, Miami, you know, Hub, 2 weeks ago, if you told me this was one of the games we'd be talking about in this significant games portion of the program, I'd have said, you're nuts. But the Panthers come in 7-3 on a six-game winning streak, and the Dolphins at 5-5 since the Richie Incognito thing blew up. They're 2-1 over the course of the last three, following a four-game losing streak.
You know, everybody looks at this great Panthers story and they think Cam Newton immediately, and Newton has played better. There's no question about that. He was a great, dare I say it, of Cam Newton, game manager against the New England Patriots in that big upset win. He obviously is capable of all the great athletic feats, but the bottom line is he's learned how to play quarterback, and that's not the story of this football team. This defense is now fourth overall in the NFL, and they are second against the run and fourth against the pass. They've got great balance. And, Eric, I don't think anybody's talking about it, but to me, the slam-dunk defensive rookie of the year is Star Lotulelei. You look at what was wrong with this football team. They were terrible at defensive tackle. They were weak up the middle, and they had trouble in the secondary. Well, they add Lotulelei and Kwon Short in the next round, and suddenly nobody can run the football on them, and that secondary is playing. I think it may still be exploitable by the really good passing teams, which Miami is not, but, you know, I mean, they're playing as good a defense as anybody in the league. They're a legitimate contender. They're not just an interesting wild card story.
Right. I mean, I think we actually have to look at the Carolina Panthers and ask, you know, are they a Super Bowl caliber team, even in this tough NFC? And you're right about Lotulelei. Short has really come on of late. They're probably not going to have Charles Johnson this week. You know, he was leg whipped in that game against New England. Doesn't look like his MCL is going to be healthy enough, so they do have to adjust there. But they've got the bodies up front. They've got great linebackers. And that secondary, I don't know where they found some of these guys, you know, Melvin White, Robert Lester, undrafted free agents. You know, some of these guys were cast offs from other teams, Mike Mitchell and Drayton Florence, people like that. They're all playing great. The scheme works. The closer the other opponent gets to the end zone, the more they tighten up. So I love what they've done. And offensively, they have a pretty good formula. So for the Dolphins, I mean, you know, they're going to have to exploit what few matchups they have in their favor. Maybe Charles Clay, maybe a little bit of Lamar Miller, but yeah, I don't like this matchup for the Dolphins. I think the Carolina Panthers can go in there and get a win.
Even though Carolina's coming off a short week following the Monday night victory against New England. We'll be back. The headliner is next on Pro Football Weekly. The headliner is an in-depth preview of the top attraction on this weekend's NFL card. The headlining Week 12 matchup has the Denver Broncos at 9-1 on the road to take on the New England Patriots, 7-3. And, of course, yet another meeting between Tom Brady, the Patriots' field general, and his opposite, Peyton Manning, who now pilots the Denver Broncos. You know, Hub, I've got to wonder, you were in Denver last week. You saw the game between Kansas City and the Broncos. The Broncos did what they had to do, 27-17, to beat the Chiefs. Now they travel to New England to take on a Patriots team coming off a disappointing Monday night loss at Carolina, 24-20 game. Some controversy at the end of the game, as we discussed in the way we hear it. My question to you would be, how much do the Broncos have left to get it up for Kansas City on 1 week and then go on the road to New England the next?
Well, you know, there's so much talent on offense, and Peyton Manning is, you know, maybe the greatest of all time, certainly in the conversation. He's got the best group of receivers in the NFL, and so right there, they can trade paint with anybody. Their problem is that their defense isn't playing particularly well. Obviously, they held the Chiefs to 17 points, but that's a challenged offense at best. And what really was interesting about the game, the difference in that Chiefs game, was the Kansas City Chiefs, with the best pass rush in the NFL, never even breathed hard on Peyton Manning. They did an incredible job protecting him, particularly Chris Clark, who has been much maligned at left tackle, stepping in for the all-world Ryan Clady. He held Tom Bahali, I don't think we called his name, twice all week. So, you know, that's really kind of the formula for them to deal with the Patriots. Patriots. Now, you look at the New England Patriots, though, and you want to talk about trends and certain factors. I mean, A, this team got jobbed last week. They almost had a victory, in Carolina. I shouldn't say they got jobbed. They didn't do enough to win, but they should have had one more chance, and they didn't get it. Carolina's obviously a very good football team, and now they're coming home. I don't think Bill Belichick has lost back-to-back games in like 7 years or something like that. Looked at the weather forecast. It's supposed to be in the low 20s, possibly teens by the end of the game. We know Peyton Manning's record when it's under 40 degrees outside. And when you look at Chandler Jones, Wayne, he's one of the best kept secrets in the NFL right now. He's out there with 9.5 sacks, and he leads what can be a pretty good pass rush when Bill Belichick decides to get creative with his defense.
This is the 13 times Brady and Manning have played against each other in a game, and Tom Brady owns a 9-4 record, which includes a 2-1 mark in the postseason. So this is the 14th meeting between these two great quarterbacks. You look at Tom Brady's numbers this year, and if all you did was look at the numbers in the 14 touchdowns, 7 interceptions, a passer rating fairly ordinary, 83.6. But when you consider what he's had to deal with, the injuries in their receiving core, the whole new receiving group in general, playing without his safety blanket, Wes Welker, who's now with the Broncos, I think this has been one of Brady's best seasons in terms of overcoming adversity.
Yeah, I think the fact that he has this team at 7-3, and you could argue maybe should even be a little bit better when you look at the losses with all the things he had to overcome early. That passer rating has actually gone up 10 points since he got Rob Gronkowski back. They had the explosion a couple weeks ago against the Steelers where they put up 55 and everybody thought they were back. Then they struggled in the first half against Carolina, but actually had a great second half last week prior to the way that game ended. I believe Brady had a string of 13 or 14 straight completions before that final drive. So they're close. You can just see that it's coming. And yes, I mean, Brady, Manning, you know, take your pick. Brady wins on championships. Manning wins on gaudy statistics. There's no question they're two of the four or five greatest quarterbacks of all time. And it's a rare treat for those of us who are enjoying the game today that we get to see both of them playing at the same time.
Hub, do you agree with those who believe Manning has the best people around him in terms of the receiving core, Demaryius Thomas, Eric Decker, Wes Welker? Together they've combined now for 21 touchdown receptions this season. Is this the best trio you've seen in the league?
Oh, absolutely. Demaryius Thomas is the most underrated receiver in the league. James Lofton, who we both know well, the great Hall of Famer, is my broadcast partner at Westwood One. He thinks he may be the best receiver in the NFL today. And then don't forget Julius Thomas, the big tight end, who, by the way, dinged a leg last week. I don't know how he's going to be for this game, but he's got 9-10 touchdowns for him. So, yeah, it's an incredible group.
And it just sounds like nitpicking, but the weather, as you mentioned, is going to be cool. That's usually not good for Peyton Manning. Stay tuned. The Publisher's Pen is next. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. Here's this week's Publisher's Pen with Hub Arkush. Hub?
Wayne, the main topic of conversation all week has been the officiating, and it's pretty easy to make a statement about where it's at and where it's going. I've been harping on this, preaching it for the last year or two. It's not that I'm that smart. This was predictable. The NFL has tried to enact new rules to make the game safer for all players, but that's not really what they're doing. They're overprotecting quarterbacks and high-profile players. They're not helping defensive players and linemen out at all. The bottom line is that this is a very dangerous game and people are going to get hurt. If they're going to make rules, they have to be a lot clearer than this idea of not hitting players high, because the play Ahmad Brooks made on Drew Brees on Sunday, I will swear, according to the rule, was legal, but that's not the point. Brees took the hit anyway. They didn't protect him. Crowing about it afterwards, fining Brooks and making it more confusing when by their own definition he did not originally hit him in the neck or head is just making it that much harder for these guys to play, and I believe making it that much more dangerous for their players.
Thanks very much, Hub. That'll do it for Pro Football Weekly this week. Randy Meyer is the producer-engineer of Pro Football Weekly. Pro Football Weekly originates in the studios of Syndication Networks in Chicago, Illinois. For Hub Arkush, Eric Edholm, and Arthur Arkush, this is Wayne Larrabee. We'll catch you next week on Pro Football Weekly.